Yale Podcast Network.
Welcome to ISM Fellows in Conversation, a podcast from the Yale Institute of Sacred Music. The episodes in this series present a discussion between a current ISM student and a visiting researcher in the ISM Fellows program. Each year, the Institute hosts a cohort of fellows who are in residence for 1 year to pursue interdisciplinary projects and teach at Yale. The following conversation focuses on the diverse research, teaching, and creative work of a current ISM fellow.
My name is Cindy Yang. I'm a first-year MAR student concentrating in religion and the arts here at Yale Divinity and the ISM. I'm here with Dr. Samantha Slaybaugh, who is a liturgical scholar with a PhD in theology from the University of Notre Dame. Her dissertation, Liturgy and Ecstasy Among the Beguines of Roubaud, Dusseline of Digne's Vita as Liturgical Commentary and Customary, explores how the hagiographic text for Dusseline of Digne utilized narratives of her ecstatic raptures as a liturgical gloss and model for the community. Welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me, Cindy.
So I'd like to start by asking how you got interested in your field of study and what drew you to liturgical studies in the first place.
So I'm going to try to give a short answer, which is that I sort of came in sideways through a love of reading Christian mystical texts, which is these texts that are writing about experiences or an awareness of union with God or God's near presence. Mm-hmm. And so I was reading a lot of these texts when I was a master's student and realizing that so often they are situated within a liturgical or sacramental framework. Mm-hmm. So I came to them first with a sort of theological question. What is the relationship between the infinite divine and the particular enfleshed finite human? And so when I started in mysticism, that was the question that really I wanted to explore, right? How does the divine communicate with the human? This really led me into sacramental theology, where that question is explored over and over again, along with Christology. So I was really interested in Christology and sacramental theology. But then I started reading these hagiographies about women in the Middle Ages, specifically Beatrice of Nazareth, who her hagiographer, and hagiography is a genre of writing, a saint's life that promotes the holiness of a person, right? Mm-hmm. So her hagiographer, the author of this text, would write about her experiencing what was called like rapture or ecstasy, where she's sort of out of her body or out of her usual state of mind. And she would be, say, in the Mass or praying with her community, the daily prayer, the office. And she might like burst into laughter or just like faint on the ground or start dancing or doing some weird gestures, right? And that really piqued my interest because I'm like, what does the community think? Right? Like, what are they?
Yeah, if it's that so happened, bizarre. Yeah, it's so bizarre. It's such a strange, but it's an also extremely visceral reaction. Like, what would prompt that? Like, what's behind that?
Right. And as a Christian myself, I'm thinking if I were in a worship service and that happened, what would I do? And there are contemporary Christian communities in which things like this happen and they're expected to happen. Right? I don't come from that community. And so I started thinking about, you know, communal formation, how communities are formed to react to certain things. And that's really a liturgical studies question, I found out. So anyway, that's my, like, I started asking all of these questions, and the scholars who were addressing them were liturgical scholars. And so I emailed a liturgical scholar at Notre Dame, and I was like, what is your field? What do you do? And can I get a job in this field? You know, so that's the practical. I just like asked someone, what is liturgical studies? Because that was not a discipline where I was as a graduate student.
I would like to ask then how you see that as being relevant to what you want to do here at the Institute of Sacred Music.
The field of liturgical studies is small.
Mm-hmm.
So being at the ISM is fantastic if you're a liturgical scholar, because it's one of the places where you have a group devoted to liturgical studies.
Right.
So a lot of institutions, you might be the only one
who's
doing liturgical studies. Mm-hmm. And so for me to get to work with scholars like Teresa Berger or Melanie Ross is, you know, it's a fantastic opportunity. Being with the ISM Fellows Program in particular has been so great in terms of the interdisciplinary conversations we get to have, right? And so I'm working with anthropologists and musicologists and people working all over geographically, chronology-wise, methodology, and we're all asking questions about ritual, about sacred music in some way, shape, or form. And yet we're asking different questions that are similar enough and different enough that we're having these really engaging conversations, right? But we're not in an echo chamber.
Right.
That's a really magical academic space.
Yes, it is.
Right.
Yeah.
You're not speaking to just your discipline.
Right.
But you're also speaking to people who get the concerns that you have as an academic, right?
You get fresh perspectives on the same topic, which is really wonderful. It broadens your understanding of a very particular topic that you want to understand more about.
Exactly.
But might otherwise not have gotten if you just stayed within that narrow field of liturgical studies.
Right. And so you can, you know, see how people are looking at ritual and emotion and song from a Jewish perspective or from a Hindu perspective, you know, and that really drives new questions for you or helps you see new connections. And it's you know, a really unique space to be able to do that. And this particular group has been, you know, just fantastic. We have established scholars, emerging scholars, and everyone is incredibly collaborative. So it's been fun.
Yeah, I noticed that when you were talking about what drew you to liturgical studies, that there is this performance aspect of liturgy that also translates or transfers well to other artistic practices, like a musical performance or other performing arts like theater or dance. What I really want to ask is, the main figure of your studies mentioned in your PhD, Dusseline of Digne, specifically if there was anything about her liturgical practices and how the, you know, the divine was manifesting in her performance of liturgy.
There are several reasons why the text that I'm working on, which is a hagiography for Dusseline of Digne. And so I also want to make clear, right, we don't know exactly what Dusseline of Digne did in the liturgy, right? Because we have, she's mediated through this particular genre that operates in certain tropes and has certain purposes and functions. All of that aside, it's what I'm interested in is how the figure of Dusseline becomes important for the liturgical practice of the Beguines. And so this text is great because it was actually written by her community, by a woman or probably a group of them as a collaborative process. And they constructed, they wrote this text, which is, for a medieval scholar, fantastic because most hagiographies are written in Latin by male clerics. Right? And so we have these Latin vitae about holy women written by male authors. And so that's a different methodological question in terms of, is this how men saw women? Is this how men wanted women to behave?
Right.
Or is this actually what the women themselves valued or experienced? Or what's the relationship between the subject and the male hagiographer, who may have been a confessor and may have had an intimate relationship with the person they're writing about? Okay, all of those questions are, there's extensive scholarship on this.
Right.
The text I'm working on is written by a woman in the vernacular for the community. And so in terms of what the community actually valued and thought about, or at least the hagiographer of this text. This is a really unique resource.
Right.
In terms of how that impacts Dusalin as a liturgical performer, we see the text is much less concerned than other texts about or by 13th century mystical women about the content of her experiences than it is about the performance of them. This text is concerned about Dusalin as a saint, but is also equally concerned about their community.
I see.
And preserving their community, promoting the Beguine way of life that Dusalin set forth for them, because she's the founder of these communities in what's now southern France. When this text was written, they didn't have papal approval. Right. And the status of Beguines was up in the air in terms of what were they? Beguines are these lay women, right, who live in community together. They act like religious women in many ways, but they don't take solemn vows and they don't belong to a recognized religious order like the Franciscans or the Benedictines or the Cistercians, right? And so the church is asking, like, what do we do with these women, right? And you have various answers, right? Some people loved them, some people hated them. This particular community had great political support from important secular powers in the region that I think aided their ultimate papal approval in the 1320s. But the hagiographer seems very concerned with preserving their community at a time in which it's not sure. And so this is the interesting part, is that the liturgical practices seem important to that project. That having a liturgical identity enabled them to preserve something about being a Beguine that both allowed them to be Beguine, but allowed them to be Beguines within the liturgical context that they were living in. So with the Franciscans in their cities, with whom they frequently worshipped, probably at the major cathedral in Marseille, for example. So they're worshiping in all of these various settings, and that ritual formation becomes a communal formation, right? Allowing them to solidify and legitimize, like, we're really, you know, we're Beguines and we're not troublesome Beguines. you know, we're not here to make trouble. We're not setting out, we're showing up at the liturgies, right? We're praying, we're devout, we're respecting the priests, right? We're listening attentively to the sermons, that sort of thing. How that relates to ecstasy, right? Is that I think the ecstatic raptures of Dusalin become models for how they should be performing the liturgy. As a liturgical scholar, as a scholar interested in recovering women's voices, to see how the author crafts these spectacular narratives.
Right.
And much of the scholarship has focused on, like, look, she's levitating. Look, her feet are being burned with boiling lead. Like, she's being pricked with needles. Like, okay, yeah, so these are all very, very interesting facets of the narratives. But there's more to it than just hagiographic tropes about, you know, women doing these paramystical bodily things.
Yeah, it sounds like the emphasis on community and communion with each other, not just with the divine, but also with each other, is especially pertinent to whoever wrote this hagiography. There's a sort of a sense of assertion in their own kind, almost like unapologetic kind of defense for themselves, right? They're writing in a vernacular. They're not following elite conventions of writing in Latin and needing authority from the Pope in Rome or something like that. There's a way in which they sort of take it upon themselves to assert their own religious community that they see as valid for themselves and wanting to preserve it in some way in hagiography. My question, I guess, then is if there's a way in which these ecstatic experiences, these unusual aesthetic experiences where Dusalin is levitating, or like you said earlier, her feet being boiled by lead, I believe. That's very extreme. It's very extreme range of ascetic experiences. And I don't know if there's a way in which that somehow is, would that be considered heretical by the church, or what's the context of that?
No.
Or if this is like something different, this is similar to, or this is like a rather common experience among other mystics like Hildegard, for example. I'm thinking of her, but she's all the way in Germany, so it's a little, the context
is
not quite.
Hildegard is quite popular even in her own time, right? Mm. Like she's quite well known. But it's definitely drawing upon hagiographic tropes. And so, for example, Mary Magdalene is incredibly important in this region. Mm-hmm. Her legendary material, that is the stories told about Mary Magdalene that are not necessarily biblical, right? Mm-hmm. She gets conflated with a lot of other Marys in the Middle Ages, including Mary of Egypt and her hagiographic tradition. And if you didn't know, Mary Magdalene was said in these legendary materials to have gone to France, to Provence, and evangelized there. Mm-hmm. And so her cult is very important, specifically where Juscelin and the Beguines are living, right? Mm-hmm. In her hagiographic material by the 13th century, we get stories about her levitating during of the offices of... the day. You can point to any number of saints in which they're levitating, and it has to do with the medieval understandings of the body and sanctity and how God is revealed in a finite body, what God does. And so the sort of expectation that she would levitate, that it might not automatically be like, wow, she's a saint, but the way that the hagiographer is portraying it is absolutely.
So it's following those conventions.
Exactly.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. And that's to her benefit, right? Because if their founder is a saint, their community's legitimacy is much easier to fight for. So Juscelin's brother, Hugh of Dean, is a famous Franciscan preacher. Mm-hmm. He helps, according to the Vita, establish these communities. He writes them a rule. Mm-hmm. They're very close with the Franciscans. And so actually Juscelin's hagiography draws on St. Francis's hagiography. And there's a lot of very deliberate borrowing from Bonaventure's life of St. Francis, the major life of St. Francis. Mm-hmm. And this is the author, I think, very deliberately crafting a saint within the Franciscan order. Although they are not Franciscans. They're very insistent that they're not Franciscans. They're Beguines. They are Beguines who are protected by the Franciscans.
Okay, So it sounds to me like the aesthetic experiences are not as distinctive as one might initially think.
So,
are they?
So when you just look at the sort of hagiographic tropes, right?
Okay.
You're not looking at much that's super surprising. But what is really unique about this text is what Juscelin does when she's levitating. Let me give you an example. In terms of like the communal formation of these narratives, on the Ascension, one year, Juscelin is wrapped under a tree. And her sisters are like, let's go pray the office. And she's just like out of it, right?
Right.
So they go pray the office with the Franciscans and they come back and she's still out of it. The curfew bell rings and, you know, in the city, and they need to go inside. And so they're thinking about, we need to bring her inside. And she all of a sudden stands up and she goes in and she reverences the relics that are in their dormitory. Because they hadn't built an oratory yet to house the relics in. And she starts processing through the dormitory. And then she'd pause, and then she'd say something that they couldn't quite understand, and then she'd move, and then she'd pause like she was listening, the hagiographer tells us, to a litany, right? And then she'd respond. And so the hagiographer is showing how she is doing this heavenly procession, right? She's processing with the angels.
Right.
And she's chanting these sort of hard to understand things. Some of it they could understand, like mm-hmm. new Jesus, new. This is similar to a dedication liturgy. Okay. And so I look at the antiphoner for the Cathedral of Marseille where, and the, for the Feast of Dedication, and I look at pontificals for the way that dedication liturgies were, like how they were shaped in the 13th century. So what the Beguines might have known, mm-hmm. not like the specifics of the prayers and whatnot, but like what happened, right? You have these processions around a church, right?
And that action itself or that kind of undertaking is unusual as a kind of manifestation yes. of the divine for
yes.
Dusseline. Yeah.
Yes. And so, and then the Beguines follow her with candles, like joining her in the procession, right? Like,
wow.
So all of this is incredibly unusual for a woman in rapture to be leading a liturgy, right?
Yeah, like, that is very unusual.
So this is, actually, I find that it's easier to talk about Dusseline's Vita when I give these examples, right?
So
I can talk about communal formation and blah, blah, blah. But what my book does is really like looks at these examples case by case, like on their own,
right?
To see, look, this is how it's happening here. Look, this is how it's happening here. Look, this is how it's happening here. And then you start to see the systematic way in which the hagiographer is forming the community to understand liturgy and using narratives of ecstasy to do that.
Yes.
So she's using these hagiographic tropes, but in a different way than we normally see.
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. There is a combination of tropes that are conventional within the time of the practice, but there's also something very unique about the way Dusseline is undergoing that divine experience in her liturgical practice that the hagiographer was very keen on preserving. It seems unusual from someone else like Hildegard, for example, who engaged in manifestation of the divine through other sacred arts, like writing liturgical songs, but not in the same sense of being in the zone where she's walking around as a processional in the church. In that way, the manifestation of the divine has a more ephemeral nature to it. What I mean by that is it's not as though we have, with reference to Hildegard, for example, copies of her manuscripts or songs or material culture that we have to get a better sense of like how, you know, she was thinking about communion with the divine. So there's something ephemeral, and it was more just like having someone else, her followers or whomever, try to capture that for her instead. So there's very something distinctive about that.
Yeah, of course, Dusseline has left us nothing, right? Like no writings. Like we just have writings about her for the most part, right? So, I mean, she's not like composing theological treatises.
Right.
Or, you know, and the process of writing about visions is a very important area of study for medieval women. But what you've named is that that means that we're studying these really exceptional women who had the resources to do this.
Right.
Something that drew me to the study of Beguines in particular was that these are just lay women trying to live a holy life, but not able to or not wanting to become professed nuns. And they're really doing this constructive work about what does it mean to be a Beguine, right? And this particular community is really invested in that question. And so it's not ephemeral in the sense of they're writing down the important things about being a Beguine.
Right.
But the experiences Dusseline has or is reported to have had, right, those aren't essential to be to the Beguine's project, at least as we have it preserved to us. It could be that this community wrote a ton about Dusseline's mystical experiences, and we just don't have those texts, right? And so this is, you're naming a problem of historical research, right? We can only study what we have, right? And I can't go back and create, right,
what
these performances. All I have is the mediated version of history, which is this genre of hagiography. And so that's part of my project, is saying, like, what do we do when we don't have texts from various communities? How can we study their liturgical performances?
And their liturgical performances are just as valid and legitimate as, for example, someone like Hildegard, who was coming from a more elite context with presumably more resources to write their songs or write down her visions or draw whatever she was seeing. But it sounds to me Dusseline's particular way in which she's engaging with the divine is distinctive. As you said earlier, it you can only study it through a mediated experience that is written by someone else. There's still a way in which the divine manifests itself. It seems somewhat unique, or there's something precious about that experience that it might not be if we had like liturgical songs instead and we studied that and tried to recreate that.
Yeah. So in terms of the value of the ecstatic raptures themselves as something that the hagiographer is very intentional about preserving. The bulk of the hagiography is concerning her ecstatic raptures and her visions and her prophecies. Like, these are very like important aspects for the hagiographer to preserve, in part because it helps build a picture of sanctity, right? She's a holy woman. Look at her doing these holy, exceptional things. But for the Beguines, I think for the Beguines who are not sure what's going to happen upon the death of their charismatic holy leader, will they survive? Will they just like dissolve and join other orders? Like, will they be approved? Will they be accepted? Will they be interrogated? There are lots of real questions happening. And so what I want to highlight is that I think the fact that Dusseline experiences rapture is really important, not because of the content theologically of the experiences, but because God is being made present to the community through Dusseline, that God is near. God is with and for the Beguines. This is the picture I think the hagiographer wants to paint for the community, who appears to be very anxious.
And almost fragile in a sense. There's a sense of fragility kind of
Looming around. And so this is a real theological and pastoral move by the hagiographer to say, not like, well, look, we're going to fight for Dusseline's mystical theology. Like, she's a great theologian. But God has revealed God's self to us in Dusseline. And that preserving God's presence in that is the hagiographer's theological endeavor. And that's really important. And I think it opens up it possibilities for the Beguines in their liturgical life and their devotional life, promotes a certain type of spirituality. It's well situated within the Franciscan context, which is dramatic and made to be accessible to a wide audience. But I think that theological, pastoral, and that emotional consolation of like feeling like we don't know what's going to happen. But let's remember what God has done for Dusseline, This is this is why we have scripture. It's we don't know what's going to happen. But let's tell the story again about what God has done for us, what God did for our people in the past, so that we have hope going into the future that God will do this again. This is what the hagiographer is doing for the Beguines. Look what God has done for Dusseline. God will do this again for us.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful idea. The stakes are much higher when there's not as much power, perhaps, that they have.
To be fair, I mean, like, I don't want to eliminate the fact that the women are well-connected politically, at least the women that we know about. They had well-connected women in the community.
I take that back,
They might not all have been, we don't know who all was in these communities, but Duseline, like, wrote letters and advised the Count of Anjou, who was in the political ruler of the region, right? She's actually, like, a political
gotcha. Okay, so there's a lot more.
Here.
Yeah, there's a lot more underneath that.
There really is. There's a lot to this community to study, which is really, you know, it's a really fun text. There's all of these different layers. But in terms of, like, church hierarchy, they might have more political, secular influence than they do ecclesial influence, as far as we know it. Through the evidence. They're certainly, like, associated with the Franciscans and a particular faction of the Franciscans. But I think, like, they're still lay women.
And there's still, like, a sense of vulnerability among them.
Yeah.
Yet that
absolutely
is really, it permeates their identity, even their communal identity, perhaps.
Yes. Yeah. And this is for a variety of reasons. Coming to the fore at the turn of the 14th century. And we don't need to go into the details about, like, the Council of Vienne, which prohibited certain kinds of Beguine communities, but it was a very confusing prohibition, right?
Yeah.
So, like, there's a variety of things happening that I don't think we need to get too much into, but it's a quite turbulent
time period.
Especially in this region.
Yeah.
For this particular community and their various associates. And so they're both elite women, for sure, but they are still low on the totem pole in terms of ecclesial power, right? Especially because they don't have an approved rule. They might be troublesome Beguines who, you know, right? So there's a real portrayal of, like, no, we are fine. We're not going to overthrow the church.
Right.
We're not going to do away with the sacraments. We're not going to disturb the ecclesial powers that be in the region, right? And yet, at the same time, in the same breath, she's presenting us a picture of lay women leading liturgies in a way that we don't see in many other places, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so this hagiography is really, I think the author is quite ingenious in pushing the boundaries and subverting expectations while using also accepted tropes and meeting certain expectations from outside forces. Right,
there's a delicate balance among all of it, and I'm assuming that's part of what makes it stand out to you as an object of study.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. There is this very particular aesthetic experience that Duseline has. Duseline's very particular aesthetic experience of processing around the church, but then also there's the outside world on the horizon, like threatening a little bit of that. There's something striking about that image, like, in my head as I'm listening to it. I can see why you'd want to study this further. There's a lot of implications, I think, underneath.
Yeah.
So it sounds super exciting.
I love it.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing. I found it super helpful for me to understand better what it means in general to study liturgical studies and seeing how deeply meaningful it can be to a community and the way they understand their identity. There is a way in which you want to make a kind of psychological peace within yourself to confront that that unknown and still have hope for the future, no matter how things end. So
yeah, absolutely.
So in your bio, you said that you aim to present a new method for assessing liturgical formation of medieval Beguines when official liturgical manuscripts are lacking. And you had referenced this a little bit earlier in our conversation, but I was curious if you could elaborate about the tension between your new methods as opposed to the quote-unquote old methods in liturgical scholarship, and what the added value of that would be.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to say a bit more about this. I want to say it's the new approach that I'm taking is not necessarily because of inherent problems with old methods or approaches to studying medieval liturgy or medieval Beguines, but it's new because it's trying to fill a gap. It's from my perspective, there are scholars who work on Beguines and there are scholars who work on medieval liturgy. And there's not much for scholarship on medieval Beguine liturgy. Now, this is, of course, because most medieval Beguine communities have not left us traditional, quote unquote, liturgical sources, like a breviary or antiphoner or customary or an ordo, you know, any number of sources that medieval liturgists tend to gravitate towards. So when you're studying medieval liturgy, you're of course beholden to those sources that exist.
Yes.
Those might be manuscript sources, and they're very frequently manuscript sources, especially if you're, you want to know the text or the music that was being chanted or was prescribed for a given rite. It might be church buildings, architecture, it might be art, stained glass windows or tapestries. It might be material culture. What objects were used in the ritual? How did the manuscript or the codex function as an object? Medieval liturgists have thought a lot about these questions, right? And these are the sources that we use. But the community I study left us no buildings. No liturgical, quote unquote, traditional liturgical sources, no art that we know was present in their buildings. You know, I don't have any like objects from the community to study. I have this hagiography and I have some archival legal documents from some of the Beguines, but not much. And so, as a liturgical scholar, you're like, how do you study the liturgy?
Yeah, it's very unconventional. It's, it's kind of a tricky question.
And for people who study Beguines, right, they're not studying the liturgy because most of the communities are lacking a real depth of liturgical source material, right? And so my approach is to say, look, we have a lot of hagiographies for these women. These are a source that exist for many, many of these women and from different communities. What if we looked at this kind of text again and asked what potential it affords for liturgical formation for the community? Might the community have used it to shape the understanding of what happens in the liturgy, to shape the understanding of how to experience the liturgy, how to feel during the liturgy, how to perform the liturgy, right? It's not a traditional liturgical text. It's not like a rubric. You know, first you do this, then you do this, and then you chant this, and then you bow here, right? Like, it's not that kind of a liturgical source. And yet, how the narratives function as a liturgical source, I think, is to me very evident, especially in this particular text. And so that's the sort of new approach that I hope to put forth, is that we need to look at these hagiographies as belonging to part of the liturgical formation of the communities, right?
Yeah, they're central to their identity. And there's a way which, even though there it might not rely on traditional sources like architecture or material culture or manuscripts, it doesn't lessen their value, and it doesn't, it certainly doesn't lessen their importance. And in the end, their experiences of how they communed, if that's communed with God, is central nonetheless. And deserves to be looked at in its own, on its own terms, and on equal terms with other liturgical sources of study.
And that traditional liturgical sources can help us understand and unpack how the hagiography can be viewed in that family, right? And I think that's been the most difficult thing, because scholars studying, say, Beguines or medieval women might not have the liturgical training or interest to work with a bunch of liturgical manuscripts. Or they might, and there's just a dearth of evidence, right? It really varies. But from a liturgical scholar's perspective, I'm looking at the hagiography, but I'm looking at it in conversation with contemporary extant liturgical manuscripts. And that affords you a a type of interpretation and reading of the text that you can't get if you're just reading the hagiography.
Right.
And you can start to see how the liturgy is being received.
Right.
And commented upon in the hagiographic genre.
Yeah, there's a broader context to situate that text in, and it really broadens the insights that you can get in understanding what this text was about and what it meant to Dusalene and her community at large.
Yes.
Well, thank you for being on the show. It was a pleasure to speak with you, and best of luck to you as you continue your research here at the ISM.
Yes, thank you so much, Cindy. I enjoyed our conversation.
For more information on the ISM Fellows Program, please visit ism.yale.edu/fellowships. Please join us again for more episodes of ISM Fellows in Conversation.